Welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. Behavior Analysis in Practice is a podcast committed to narrowing the research practice gap and demystifying the research process. Each episode will take a deep dive into the latest work published in Behavior Analysis in Practice, the journal, by interviewing the paper's author about the topic. We'll explore the nuances of each paper and ask the questions you wish you could ask the authors after reading the paper. Hello and welcome back to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. I'm your host, Cody Morris, Assistant Professor of Behavior Analysis at Salve Regina University. And today I'm going to be speaking with Kohei Togashi about his paper focused on a telehealth parent training program that he conducted in Japan. Kohei earned his PhD from Western Michigan University under the mentorship of Dr. Dick Malott as a Fulbright Scholar. He is currently based in Japan, where he serves as the President of Behavior Solutions and an adjunct faculty member at Chow University and Temple University's Japan campus. Kohei is also working on translating Principles of Behavior by Malott and Kohler into the Japanese language and is very much dedicated to disseminating the knowledge of behavior analysis across Japan. My conversation with Kohei about his project based in Japan was very interesting. I think you're going to enjoy it. So without further ado, here's my interview with Kohei Togashi. Hi, Kohei. Welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast.
Hi, Cody. Thank you for having me.
It's a thrill to have you on here. I mean, first of all, your paper is very interesting, and I'm really glad we get to talk about it. But for those that don't know, Kohei and I went to grad school together, and so it's fun to get to connect, and we've stayed connected since grad school. But it's just nice to have you on here and to be able to talk about your research.
Yeah, thanks, Cody.
Of course. So we're going to dive into the topic of your paper and kind of talk about all the nuances there. But before we do, we like hearing a little bit about our guests. So would you mind telling our listeners what your current role is, where you're living, what you're up to, and how you came to be involved with this research that we're going to be talking about today?
Yeah. So my name is Kohei Togashi. I'm a BCBAD and clinical psychologist certified in Japan. Currently, I'm based in Japan and serve as a president of Behavior Solutions in Tokyo. At Behavior Solutions, I offer a range of services, including in-home ABS services for children with ASD, as well as consultation and training for practitioners and parents. I also teach and conduct research at two universities in Tokyo. One is Chuo University and another university is Temple University Japan campus. So several factors influence my decision to design and conduct the current research. First, when I was given the opportunity to plan and conduct the research, I wanted to conduct research that would benefit participants and promote the international dissemination of ABA. So I selected vocal mental skills for children with ASD because lack of adequate mental repertoire is often an issue for many children with ASD. And I also wanted to involve parents in the study because in Japan, the number of behavior analysts is limited. And developing a program that effectively teaches parents to implement behavior analytic procedures could mitigate those issues. There are some other factors that influenced my decision. And the second reason is when I was planning this study, some children and families had discontinued service due to the impact of the COVID pandemic. So in addressing this challenge, I intended to incorporate telehealth component in this study. This addition would help mitigate impact of disruptions related to COVID and ensuring the service could continue with minimal interruptions. And number three, third, certain systematic reviews, such as the one conducted by Akamoru et al. In 2020, proposed that the literature on telehealth parent training and parent implemented communication lacks scientific rigor. And this criticism is based on the observation that those communication studies employed non-experimental designs, such as the pre-post or ABA design, and were lacking crucial information, such as a detailed description of the procedure and procedural integrity data. In connection with this concern, in 2021, Yamaguchi et al. Published a similar systematic review, and that kind of caused me to conduct this research.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing all that, Kohei. And that's, a perfect segue into the study and beginning to unpack exactly what you did. Now, one of the things you refer to as one of the contextual pieces for the study is that it's being conducted in Japan during COVID or in and around the COVID pandemic. For those who are unfamiliar with the state of behavior analysis or the resources related to behavior analysis within Japan, could you tell us a little bit about that so we have a sort of a general idea of the context under which you're doing this study?
Yeah. So there's no reliable information. There's no evidence for the state of the ABA services in Japan. So these are all anecdotal, but in Japan, there's no reliable credential system for ABA practitioners. So in the US, we have the BACB credentials, and those are pretty well established across the country. But in Japan, there's no such credential. So we don't know how many competent professional behavior analysts are there in Japan, but anecdotally, there are limited number of competent behavior analysts in Japan. And also another huge gap between US and Japan is the funding for those ABA services. In the US, those ABA services are funded through insurance. But in Japan, we don't have such systems. So often, there are some exceptions, but often people pay for their ABA services from their own pockets. So there's a lot of financial burden for the clients.
So in general, it sounds like just, far fewer resources. And even, there are people in America even experience difficulty with resources and access. But it sounds like, for the reasons you stated, Japan is certainly in the category of needing many more resources and really having probably not their infrastructure to support what I'm assuming is a pretty high demand given just the size of the population that lives in Japan.
Exactly.
And with the COVID pandemic, I imagine that did not help the situation in terms of people available to help provide services, probably financial resources to pay for services, considering people are paying out of pocket, and all of those variables. And so as you're setting out to look at targeting, very important and critical skills in the clients you're serving clinically, figuring out a way of doing that in a context where there aren't many resources.
That's right.
So this study was kind of focused on the parental or parent delivered man training, if
That's
I'm
right.
Understanding that correctly.
Yes.
And the system for training them, the parents, to deliver that man training, and the sort of modality under which that all was being done, given it was a telehealth study. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Can we talk about the specific training model that you were interested in utilizing in this study. So we'll talk, about your specific procedures later on, but just generally speaking, talking about the training structure that you were using in this study.
So, the entire training was conducted online, and we were using behavior skills training format for the parent training. As many of the audiences will know, BSD consists of explanation of rationale, written description of the procedure, model rehearsal, and feedback. So I adhere to the standard model of the BSD for the training.
And that training was done with parents being trained to deliver man training for their children that had ASD. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Can we talk about how you recruited participants given the complications of getting services within Japan and like who your participants were in terms of general characteristics?
So this study was conducted at Keio University in Tokyo. And when I joined the research team, there was already a research program established. So they had a pool of some participants that could benefit from this study. So one source of the participants were from the already existing research participant pool. And I also approached some local hospitals and centers that offered treatment for kids with autism. So some participants came from there too.
Were the participants, or I should say, because you kind of have two sets of participants here, right? You have the children and you have the parents. Were the children already receiving ABA services, regardless of where you were recruiting for them from? Or was this some of their first sort of contact with ABA?
Right. So none of them had previous experience, or they weren't receiving any ABS services. And I've used men training procedure in my research, but none of them have any experience with the men training.
And with that, what was the so they none of them had experienced ABA. I imagine all of them needed to demonstrate the need for manned training. Were there other inclusionary criteria or even exclusionary criteria for the participants?
Right. So the children needed to be ages between 3 and 7, and if they had severe problem behavior, they could not participate in the study. The reason being because the entire study was conducted online. If the child had a severe problem behavior, I wasn't able to go to their homes and help the parent, and because they didn't know how to manage that they may not know how to manage safely manage the problem behavior. I decided to include that in my exclusion criteria.
That makes sense. And I think that kind of goes along with our do no harm first, right? And with clinical work and wanting to make sure that we're providing services that are done in a way that we're going to maintain safety and not put anyone at any unnecessary risk. Now, you had mentioned that the study was done in the family's homes via telehealth. Is that correct?
That's right. So the parents were in their homes, but I was working from the university in Tokyo.
So, how did you arrange the technology piece of that arrangement? Was it that they were they using their own device? Like, how did that work?
So, one of my main sort of mo motivation for this study was to disseminate applied behavior analysis. And to do that, I wanted to use low cost and commercially available devices. So all of my participants, our participants, used their own devices. And I also sent them a video recording device, which was iPod. They had a video recording function, and that's pretty much it. So, you know, they use their own devices plus an iPod device, which is not that expensive and commercially available in many countries, you know, including Japan.
Were you, with the telehealth model that you were using, were you live streaming with these families, or were they recording and sending you the videos? Like, what did that piece look like?
Okay, so the training took place, you know, at the same time. So it was live training. But after parents completed the training with the researcher, they recorded their interaction with their children on those videos. And I later viewed those, you know, recorded videos at my convenience. So it wasn't, you know, kind of live analysis or, you know, videos later.
In vivo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, did you have any issues with the connectivity piece during the sort of live components of that, or were all the families in areas where they had good connectivity? Like, what did that look like?
Yeah, just one participant had not very good, you know, Wi-Fi connectivity. So in one session, we had to, you know, disconnect and reschedule the session. And that's, you know, something that we couldn't really control. It's, you know, so the connectivity was dependent on, you know, what's available in the client's home. So, yeah, I did have that issue.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. A lot of the people I speak with that do telehealth are, even in areas like, you know, very populated cities that have great internet infrastructure, can struggle with connectivity sometimes, which complicates things.
Yeah.
So we talked about the participants, we talked about the settings, we talked about the materials. What were the primary dependent variables that you were looking at in the study?
Yeah. So there were two main dependent variables. One is the child's responses. So those are the main responses of the children. And another main dependent variable was the accuracy of the parents' implementation of the procedures. And in addition to those two main dependent variables, I also took measurement on social validity. And it was assessed at all three levels that Wolf mentions, and namely social significance of the goals, social appropriateness of the procedure, and social importance of the effects.
So the first two dependent variables you talked about, so you were talking about like manned accuracy,
right,
and then you were talking about the accuracy of the parents implementing the procedures, which, mm-hmm, you know, for the manned accuracy makes sense, right? Because that's the student's or the child's acquisition of the goals we're targeting. And of course, the parents' delivery of the procedures being the one of the main components here. Why the social validity? Why is that an important component of the study?
Yeah. So, you know, the procedure I've used is very simple. It's a standard, you know, main training procedure, and it's proven to be effective. But it doesn't mean, you know, it's socially valid in any situations or any cultures. And there aren't, you know, many studies that evaluate social validity at those three levels I've mentioned in Japan. And I wanted to make sure that effective intervention are also socially valid in this cultural context.
I love that. And I think that's important in any study, but potentially arguably even more so in a country that may not have access to services as readily, may not have the amount of exposure that maybe other areas do, and, you know, obviously have different cultural variables that could come into play that may not be adequately captured in the existing research,
right,
that is of interest there. So I love that you looked at the social validity piece. I'm excited to dive into, you know, what you found with that. But I think that that's critical, and that in any situation, as I said, but you know, especially when you're essentially being a path developer, right, where you're helping Japan grow its ABA infrastructure and disseminate information about ABA, as a social validity piece being absolutely essential here. The procedures you did in the study started with a pre-baseline assessment. Can you talk about what that consisted of, and why you did that?
So before the baseline condition, the researcher met with each participant individually to collect demographic information such as age and to identify reinforcers. And to identify reinforcers for the men training, we have conducted preference assessment plus informal reinforcer assessment.
You did all that to give yourself the supporting components of this intervention, right? Understanding what the putative reinforcers are going to be that you use, et cetera.
That's right. Yep. Setting up for the intervention.
The next phase of your study was a phase you call preparation. Can you talk about what that piece looked like?
So it's after, doing the pre-baseline assessments and identifying the reinforcers for the procedure. First parents, I sent parents what we call parent training package. And also lecture videos. And those materials contained overview of the study and some general information about ABA and verbal behavior and how to use those video recording devices and cloud storage to share those videos that parents recorded. Once parents received those package and lecture videos, meeting with researcher was scheduled. And during those meeting with the researcher, the information obtained during pre-baseline assessment was used to determine target behavior for the child in collaboration with the parent, so that the target behavior is socially valid for the parent
And
and
that
also for the
target
child.
behavior being a man, so you're determining what man specifically, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And novel vocal man was target behavior.
And what were the different mans that were targeted for your clients, if you have that information handy?
So those are meant for tangible items, and during the assessment, during the preference assessment and informal reinforcement assessment phase, we've included both, edible, a variety of, stimuli, right? It's not just edible, toys, activities, etc. But it happened to be, all of the children had edible reinforcers for the training. So one client had juice, snack, grapes. One client had icy water as reinforcer. And Yuma, the last client, had a variety of edible items. It wasn't any, specific, but a variety of edible items was reinforcer for him.
And were the mans related to those reinforcers? Were those generalized mans or specific mans? So, for example, and with that last participant, you talked about them having a variety of tangibles. So, were they asking specifically, or was it just a general man?
So some men's were specific. So for example, for Ryo, Gaku, those are the names of some of the fake names of the participants. Those are specific, one was juice, another one was snack, and another one was grapes. So those are specific, but for the remaining participants, those are generalized manned. Please pour and give me more.
And so you get those established with the parents, you get a sense of, the other components of how you're going to support the client's learning in these areas. And then you conducted a baseline. What did that baseline look like? What were you measuring? How did you do that?
Yeah, so after selecting target behavior, parents receive training on how to perform baseline probes with children. So it wasn't the researcher that conducted the baseline, it was the parent. And during the baseline probe, the parent held the preferred item until the child engaged in a main response. And this main response didn't need to be the target main response. It could be any form of main response, for example, you know, just reaching for the item or, you know, grabbing the item, and or until the 3 seconds had elapsed. And, you know, any form of main response was followed by, you know, access to the reinforcer. And after the probe was conducted by the parents without any error for 3 consecutive trials with the researchers present, so when I was present online, the parent completed at least 10 baseline trials per day with their children twice a week. And those baseline trials were conducted by parents during daily routine and without the researchers present. And they recorded the the implementation of the baseline probes using the video recording device and share the video files with the researcher for later viewing.
Were you looking at the parents' implementation during baseline, or were you only looking at the child's manding during baseline?
So I was looking at the child's manding, and all the parents received the training to, you know, on how to implement the baseline probe, and they, you know, implemented the probe accurately. So I was mainly looking at the child's manding response.
Gotcha. And then the next phase of the study was what you call the general procedure. So you talk about training that you did and then the parent independent trials. Can you talk about what those phases look like?
Yeah. So the general procedure was training with the researcher. So parent went through training with me online, and then they went on to, you know, work with their children in the daily routine. So the training with the researcher was conducted after obtaining adequate baseline data. The researcher shared a video demonstration of the manned training procedure with the parent first, and then I trained the parent to implement the procedure. And in the initial training with the parent, written description of the procedure was shared using the screen sharing function of the video conference system that we were using. The researcher also explained the rationale, followed by demonstration of the procedure. And following the demonstration, the parent practiced the procedure with the researcher. So me acting as a child and parent, you know, being the implementer. After each practice trial, the researcher delivered vocal praise or collection as performance feedback. And the training continued until parent implemented the procedure with 100% accuracy for at least 3 consecutive trials within that training. And that's the training with the researcher component. And parent independent trials took place after parents completing the trial, the training with the researcher. The parent began the intervention by conducting at least 10 trials of the procedure per day, twice a week, during daily routines without researchers present. So parents, and then parents, of course, video recorded the interaction with their children while implementing those procedure. And after parents began to implement the procedure, the parent met with the researcher weekly for 1 hour. And during those meetings, the researcher delivered feedback using graphs and videos. Also, the researcher delivered training on the next phase when the data indicated that the child demonstrated independently demonstrated the target response.
Can you provide sort of a general description of what the procedures were that the parents were delivering? I don't want you to have to go through, you know, nitty-gritty exact procedures, but just like generally speaking, what did the procedure look like?
Okay. So it involved, you know, some like common components across all phases. One is, you know, withholding access to the reinforcer, and also conducting a single stimulus preference assessment before initiating those men training to ensure that there's a, you know, motivating operation for the reinforcers they were using, and providing reinforcement for their men response, for the target response. And in phase one, we've used immediate vocal prompt for the men response. So in addition to those components that I've just described, the parent delivered a vocal model immediately after, you know, showing the preferred stimulus to the child.
So the description of the procedures is helpful. And one of the pieces you talked about in the training component,
yes,
was like, I think you had said the researcher like role played as I believe the child, where they play. So how was the parent doing the man training with someone virtually? Like how were they, you know, quote unquote, like delivering the reinforcer to the researcher who's on the other side of a computer screen? Like, what did that look like?
Okay. Yeah. So, like you said, you know, we can't actually deliver. Parents could not give me the actual reinforcer through the screen. So they kind of, you know, we've decided certain actions, and that indicated the delivery of the reinforcer. So in the study, reaching toward the camera, so it looked like, you know, parents were delivering something to me. That indicated when, you know, that the parent delivered a reinforcer. So yes, does that kind of answer your question?
It does. Yeah. And that's very helpful, I think, for people unfamiliar with or new to telehealth. I think some of those components and understanding what those look like can be confusing, because, you know, the reality is there is a limit as to what you can do via telehealth. But if, as you said, you establish these approximations, like, hey, the delivery reinforcer for the kid is you're going to give them the juice or whatever it is that they mandated for. Well, you're not going to pour juice on the computer camera, you know, but if you just, you know, move your hand toward the camera, pretend like you're handing it to me, right? Mm-hmm. That's an approximation. I can work with that. And if you're getting those pieces down, you know, it's likely you'll generalize to actually delivering the juice to the child or whatever it might be. So yeah, that it's helpful to hear about what that looked like and to get an understanding of that. Now, as you were describing your general procedures, you alluded to sort of specific phases that involved a delay or no delay with the prompts that they were delivering. Can you talk about that component?
Yeah. So the phase one of the procedure involved immediate delivery of the vocal prompt. So immediately after holding up the preferred stimulus, the parent modeled the vocal response for the child. That's phase one. Phase two was identical to phase one of the procedure, except prompt delay was, you know, added. So after presenting the preferred item, the parent waited up to 3 seconds had elapsed before delivering the vocal model. And those are the two basic phases for all participants. But for one participant named Gaku, those two phases did not improve the independent, you know, vocal mending. So we developed supplemental phase for Gaku's first mending for first target behavior. And the procedures used with you know, other participants did not work, but Gaku could read, you know, characters. So we've included visual prompt, which was hiragana letters, which is one of the Japanese alphabets, along with vocal model. So in the supplemental phase for Gaku, we've used visual prompt plus the vocal model that we were using for other participants.
It's helpful to hear about those procedures and hear how Gaku's procedures were adapted slightly based on his individual needs. What was the research design used to evaluate these procedures across the participants?
So the research design was non-concurrent, multiple baseline across participants' design. And I know some researchers argue that non-concurrent designs weren't ideal, and we should always use concurrent designs. But we used non-concurrent design for two reasons. One being, participants entered study and began baseline probes at different times, and we wanted to minimize the participants' waiting time before the intervention.
Nice. So that's helpful to know why you did the non-concurrent piece to that design. Did you consider other designs at all, or was it, we're going to have multiple participants? There's probably some issues with irreversibility with these skills. So was it pretty obviously always going to be multiple baseline for you, or did you consider other designs?
No, this was our first, choice, and our kind of our research design is kind of mixture of multiple baseline design across participants, as well as across behaviors for Gaku, because he had two behaviors.
And what were the two behaviors for Gaku?
One is meant for snack, and another one is meant for grapes.
Gotcha. And when you were evaluating the data from this study, you collected some IOA. What was that process? What did that process look like? What did you see there?
Yeah, so two independent observers viewed those recorded videos of at least 25% of the trials in each phase for all participants. And trial by trial, IOA percentage was calculated for the client's mending response. And the IOA was above 93% for each phase for all participants.
That's great. That's good IOA data. Now,
yeah.
To the main event here, what everyone is curious about is what did you see, right? So you're looking at, let's start with maybe the two primary variables with the children's manding and the parent procedural integrity. What did you see?
Yes. So in general, all children acquired a novel mand response. Gaku, he acquired two novel vocal mand responses. So during baseline, none of the children engaged in the target mands. In phase one, when the parents delivered immediate vocal prompts, immediate and increasing trends and levels were observed for all children except for Liu. In phase two, when we added prompt delay, independent mand increased for Jin and Liu. Phase two did not improve the independent mands for Gaku's first target behavior, as we talked about before. But after conducting the supplemental phase, so adding the textual or the visual prompt for three sessions, Gaku independently engaged in the target response. And as he acquired the second target response during phase one, phase two was not necessary for Gaku.
Nice. And what did you see with the parent delivered intervention?
So the procedure data confirmed that none of the parents used the phase one procedure during baseline, so they didn't have that in their repertoire. But Jean and Leo's parents implemented phase one with average procedural integrity above 80%. And Gaku and Yuma's parents had low procedural integrity for this phase, with an average of 29% and 61% respectively, but their implementation performance improved gradually. And all parents implemented phase two of the intervention with an average procedural integrity of 74% or higher, but procedural integrity for Jin's parent was highly variable throughout the intervention phase.
Where did the behavioral skills training fall? And, for the listeners, Kohei provides great graphic summaries of the data we're discussing now. But thinking about the parents' data as they relate to the baseline phase one, phase two, and for Gaku, the supplemental phase, where did the BST fall in this continuum?
Yeah, so parents received the initial training from the researcher when they began the intervention phase. But as you see on the graph, that training did not result in, perfect implementation, perfect accuracy. So during the weekly meeting with the researcher, they received those, training based on BSD. So, parents recorded their interaction with implementation with the child, and based on those weekly, video recordings, I have provided additional training as parents implemented the procedure with the child. So the training kept on going. It was kind of like a weekly training for parents, even after the parents demonstrated mastery in the initial training with me.
I see. That's helpful. And what did the training look like? Was it asynchronous? So if you're looking at videos that they had recorded and uploaded, did your supplemental training, was that also like asynchronous, or were you then Zooming or WebExing or whatever modality you use with them to do that training? Yeah. What did that look like?
So there was, it was synchronous. It was a live, training. Parents uploaded those videos and I analyzed those videos later, but the training was, synchronous.
Gotcha. And, looking at those two pieces, you saw the manding increase, you saw the procedural integrity increase. What did the social validity data look like that you collected?
Yes, so all parents rated the goal, procedures, and the effects of the study highly. And also I have, so parents' social validity was evaluated using a questionnaire. But in addition to those questionnaires, a research assistant viewed two videos for each participant, and the RA selected a video with higher performance. So this was an evaluation for social importance of effects, and RA selected videos from the intervention phase. So one video was selected from baseline, another one was selected from intervention. RA selected video from the intervention phase for all participants, meaning it supported the social importance of effects for all participants.
That's awesome. And what did you see with the parent report? I know that it was a specific form, it's probably different variables, but what were some of the highlights of other results you saw with the social validity questionnaire?
Yeah, so they gave the highest ratings for all question items, except for one item, which was the question was how effortful and time consuming was the intervention. So the highest rating for that item was one, but some participants gave two for that rating for the item.
Did you have any complications with getting accurate social validity data from the parents? I think in general, it can be hard to get that, but I think especially in certain cultures, it can be difficult for parents to feel comfortable providing sort of accurate feedback. Did you think about that? Like, how was that navigated in your study?
Yeah, so I should highlight that the social validity questionnaire we used was not validated. So in the US, in English, there are some, validated social validity measures, such as behavior intervention rating scales and treatment acceptability rating form. But in Japan, we don't have those, forms validated, or we don't have any assessment of social validity that allow us to, evaluate social validity at all three levels in Japanese language. So I had to develop those questionnaires myself, and, I didn't conduct adequate, statistical or psychometric analysis on the questionnaire I developed. So there was that kind of a complication for the survey that I have used. And like you mentioned, maybe there was some, cultural influence on how, parents responded, they knew that I will see the result of the social validity survey. So they might have, said, hey, this, study was great, when they actually thought, that this was horrible. And we never know.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that's consistent across any study, but, for example, I spoke with some practitioners who practice in the Middle East, and they had talked about how difficult it was initially to get accurate feedback from parents. But, it's just something in general, I think, our field has to continue to work toward, regardless of where you practice. But so the sort of circling back to the results of the study, it looks by far and large that the intervention to help the children develop demands was successful, that the parent implemented procedural integrity was successful, that you got good social validity data. So it seems like a big success in terms of the outcomes you were looking at. Where do you go from here? What are some things, other things that we should be considering related to this type of research?
So there were certainly some limitations of this study. So one was the fact that the data were recorded only in the client's home settings, and also we did not have the follow-up data. So we weren't able to assess the transfer and maintenance of the skills. So future studies should could replicate this study in various environments, not just limited to home environments, and also, and this is pretty obvious, obtain follow-up data would be beneficial. And also, although we require the participants to conduct at least 10 trials of the procedure per day, none of the participants except Gaku's parents met this requirement. And they said, they knew what they had to do, but they were, very busy. And another participant said, video recording was difficult. So they had to, put the iPod on the stand, turn the iPod on and, push record. And that was kind of effortful. They said it was kind of effortful for the participants. So we did have those difficulties. So in future, studies may consider how we could reduce those, complications, effortfulness for the participants. They could maybe use different recording devices or different recording methods, and still get the same kind of data.
Those are great ideas for future directions for this research in particular. When I read this study and was thinking about the different future directions, I was thinking about the sort of research questions at hand related to the man training and the parent delivered instruction. And like I said, I think you did a great job describing those directions. One of the other things I sort of was left thinking about at the end of the study was future directions for dissemination of ABA within Japan. And the introduction to the paper, you talked about the resources or lack of resources related to ABA that Japan currently has. And so, seeing that the study was successful and thinking about some of the other components within the sort of general dissemination of behavior analysis in Japan, what do you think needs to happen next? Or how does the field of behavior analysis continue to expand and be successful within Japan? Any thoughts on that? That's a big question.
Yeah. So I think, practicing philosophic doubt. So there are already empirically evaluated procedures and, techniques within ABA. But as I mentioned at the beginning, we shouldn't assume that what's proven to be effective in let's say in the US is also effective or socially valid in Japan. So we could, actively collaborate maybe across the border to make sure what we think are effective are actually effective in, you know, different locations? And if it is not effective in certain cultures, we could conduct, you know, experiments to identify what culture exactly, you know, like specific modifications may be made in order to address those, you know, cultural differences. So not just be just vaguely speaking, you know, cultural competency or cultural awareness is important. We could examine those factors in a scientific ways.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that makes a lot of sense. And I know you're working hard to do what you can do within Japan. You had mentioned teaching at two different schools and doing clinical work and this research and other research I know you're working on. And I know it's, you know, dissemination is challenging work. So thank you for the work you're doing on that. Thank you for writing up this paper. I think it was really interesting to get to see the way that you approach telehealth, the way that it was sort of viewed in Japan, and to get a chance to talk with you about this paper has been really cool. So I appreciate it.
Thank you, Cody.
And I suspect it's early over there. What time is it in Japan right now?
It's about 7 a.m.
So we started this interview 6 a.m. or so for you. Mm-hmm. So thanks for waking up early. I'm sure the listeners can relate to the difficulty of waking up at 6 a.m. and jumping straight onto a podcast interview. So I appreciate it. It's been fun, Kohei.
Thank you, Cody. It was very fun.
Thank you for listening. Please remember to subscribe and like us on whatever podcast player you use. I'd also like to take a minute to thank a few people for helping create this podcast. Thank you to Stephanie Peterson, the editor of the journal Behavior Analysis and Practice. Thank you to ABAI for sponsoring this podcast. Thank you to my assistant producers for the season, Megan Ellsworth and Jesse Perrin. And thank you to Jim Carr and his band New Latitude for letting us sample their song Cruising Altitude throughout this podcast.